It's time for Let's Talk Legal with your hosts, Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins from the law firm of Harvell & Collins. If you've got a legal question, they can give you the answer. Call now, 252-247-7282, and let's talk legal.
And welcome to Let's Talk Legal here on the Talk Station. Joining us this morning is Wes Collins and Sam Morris with us. Good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning, Ben.
Good morning, Ben.
All right, so what are we talking about today?
Ben, last week we talked a little bit about the aspect of a will caveat when it relates to the requirements for executing or properly executing a will in North Carolina. We talked about the requirements of the witnesses, primarily the fact that they either have to be present at the time that the mm-hmm. will is signed, or the person who signs the will, the testator, has to acknowledge the signature, and then the witnesses have to also actually witness or sign the document as a witness before the testator, when the, mm-hmm. when the testator is at
right,
least
in the presence,
like line of sight type right. type situation. So we went through that last week. A couple weeks ago, one of the programs I missed, the reason I missed is because Sam and I were in a trial mm-hmm. Over here in Superior Court, Carteret County, jury trial before Judge Quinn, and it was a will caveat, and that was one of the issues that we talked about, or that was before the court, was the execution. But Sam and I are going to talk today about other aspects of will caveats, maybe talk a little bit about how the process works, mm-hmm. and talk about the two primary areas that you deal with when you have a will caveat. And a will caveat's a challenge to someone's will right. after they passed away, and you know, there are issues about the will, and those issues need to be brought before a jury. And those two elements or two issues that you look at would be undue influence, which was like someone exerting influence upon someone mm-hmm. and having the document signed, and lack of capacity, which would be, you know, in North Carolina and really in all jurisdictions, there is a requirement that's pretty well set forth in the statutes, specifically set forth as it relates to what type of capacity the person has to have at the time of signing mm-hmm. in order to have the capacity required to sign a will.
Right.
You can't, you know, okay. if you're lacking capacity in one of those areas, then your will could be determined to be invalid. So that's kind of a long intro, fact-filled intro with regard to information we'll talk about today. And we do have Sam Morris today.
We do.
the canned intro said Cecil Harvell and Wes right, Collins. I was right. thinking Cecil's looking mighty young today. You know,
so Sam's been with us
for about Sam, how long have you been practicing?
It's been, I came in last, I think it was last May or last April.
Right.
Yeah. So of 2018. So it's been a little, almost a year and a half now.
Right. Right. Yeah. Yeah. So Sam's been with us for, you know, that period of time, and then was
during that time, I think we've done two or three will caveats since that time.
Yeah, you know, attorneys really don't try that many will caveats. Mm-hmm. You know, we have experience, of course, seeing what kind of cases get tried, you know, in different state courts, you know, around the area, Craven County, you know, Pitt County, Carteret, mm-hmm. you know, Onslow, Pamlico, Lenore, because we're in, or either Sam or myself normally are in Superior Court during the civil terms a lot of cases and a lot of times, and so you're able to see what kind of cases are coming up and getting tried, and you just don't see many of those right. being tried.
Yeah, you had mentioned last week about how in that particular case that you were looking at, how there were some peculiarities about the procedure that was taken
right,
during
right.
the time, but it was ultimately about influence, wasn't it?
Good memory there. So there were two issues primarily. The first one was whether the particular will was executed consistent with the requirements under North Carolina law, meaning did it have, you know, the appropriate number of witnesses? Did they actually see? Was it acknowledged? Did they sign at the time? Those mm-hmm. kind of things. And then the second issue on that case was the subject will, the product of undue influence.
Mm-hmm.
And in that particular case, those two issues were submitted to the jury. And if we won on either one of those issues, mm-hmm. then we would be in a position where we basically win the case. The will that was in question, that was highly suspect, would fall.
Mm-hmm.
You would think off the top of your head, well, why would you submit both of those issues to the jury if they answer it was not, let's say it was not executed under North Carolina law? Why do you even go to the second one? Because you've already won. Well,
right.
And that issue came up in the trial, and both of those issues were submitted to the jury. And the reason why is because we don't know if there's going to be an appeal. Mm-hmm. And in the event there is an appeal and we're unsuccessful, then we need an answer on the second question, because you can appeal just one issue and maybe the other issue saves the day.
Let's talk about the influence thing.
So basically, I get caught up into the details, because when you try these cases, the technical details of the trial and making sure that you cover everything specifically, dot your I's, cross your T's, is something that you live with every day. So it's kind of hard to get away from it. But when you talk about the undue influence, mm-hmm. Undue influence basically is when someone is exerting influence over another, basically in almost every case, to benefit themselves.
Self-dealing,
where they're putting so much pressure on the person that the person who is exerting the influence, the document in question really becomes their intent as opposed to the person who's signing it.
Right.
So I have pulled up here on my phone because
influence in and of itself is not wrong.
Well, influence, yeah. Ben, our courts have said not all influence is undue.
Right.
You can, for example, make changes to your estate planning documents based upon factors that enter your mind. I mean, you're supposed to take these things into consideration when you're making an estate plan, mm-hmm. anyways. So, for example, if someone has a child or a grandchild who's been particularly helpful to them in their later years of life, you can absolutely give them maybe more of a share of your estate than your other children, just mm-hmm. based upon those factors. And even specifically telling a testator, hey, I would like to have the 1966 Chevy Malibu or whatever it is.
Yeah, so would I. That's not matter.
Yeah, that's not undue necessarily. Undue right. influence is, you'll never find a smoking gun, so to speak. You'll never mm-hmm. find mm-hmm. an exact moment that says that's the influence. What it is it's a progression of exertion of one's will over another person mm-hmm. to the point where their will eventually, their estate planning documents really reflect the intents and desires of the person exerting the influence.
It's really a predatory thing.
It's very much so.
Yeah,
it is. And it gets to the elder abuse issue, gets to mm-hmm. the financial exploitation, the things that we hear about.
Mm-hmm.
When we look at the jury instructions, when we're talking about undue influence, there's multiple factors that come into play that mm-hmm. the jury should take into consideration.
It's highly circumstantial.
It is. And those factors are age, physical condition, mental condition, dependence on, association with, relationship with, or custody by the person exerting the influence, the opportunity to have a relationship or associate with other people,
mm-hmm.
A relationship by blood of the beneficiaries of the will, fair to include in the will the persons who would naturally be expected to receive the property, and you may also consider issues such as the will is much different than maybe a previous will. And so,
it's a totality.
And it's not one of those. It's not like, okay, you have to prove all of those issues,
mm-hmm.
all of those considerations, all of those factors, and it's not that you just have to prove, just one of them and then you win. It's just the jury should take those type of things into consideration, in order to make a determination as to whether the influence was undue. But mm-hmm. A couple of the high points with regard to that, and things that I've seen over the years that are common, is in many cases when you have someone who's exerting influence, they're isolating the person.
Mm-hmm.
They're not letting other family members talk with the person. They're coming up, let's say the children live abroad, and they're not letting the children talk with mom or dad. And they're saying, well, this is confusing to mom or dad, or mom or dad's really, their hearing has gone down.
Mm-hmm.
So they can't really talk with you on the phone. There's always, these type of excuses. So there's isolation. That's just part of the psychological aspect of this. Mm-hmm. Oftentimes the person is given information that's incorrect, such as you're running out of money. Let's make some changes about this charitable giving that you're doing. let's not give so much. Let's change this. You can't afford to give to the church. Mm-hmm. You know,
or I'll liquidate these things.
I'll take care of you. You know, don't worry about it.
So it's
make
often
me
a
your health care agent, and I'll make sure you're taken care of. You know, so
that one is often in a caregiving kind of relationship too.
In many cases, that's true. The person's in a caregiving situation, but in many cases, they have imposed themselves into that position.
Hmm. Right.
They have barged into that position, and that is just part of the control. We'll go back to undue influence in a moment as it relates to wills, but keep in mind that we see just as many cases of undue influence relating to other type of documents, like joint account designations. You know, I'll put my name on your account so I can pay your bills. All you have to do is sign this, and
right.
I'll take care of that. But the legal effect of that is when the person passes away, doesn't matter what the will says, the entire account goes to the joint owner.
Mm-hmm.
You know, change of beneficiary designations mm-hmm. on life insurance. That could be subject to undue influence. Make an account, a POD account. So what we're talking about here in this aspect of undue influence outside of the will, not part of the will, we're talking about a single issue of motivation, which is money,
mm-hmm.
which is, you know, changing these assets that are going to pass, as we've talked about many times on the program, by a designation, not by terms of the will, and then by that document, which has a lower level as it relates to execution requirements getting changed by the person.
Okay. We're going to take a short break. We'll come back with more. If you want to call in and chime in with your own question too, 247-7282. That's 247-7282 as we continue Let's Talk Legal here on the Talk Station. Hey, welcome back here at Coastal Daybreak here on the Talk Station. We're talking about challenges to a will based on undue influence or also capacity. Let's talk a little bit about capacity side of that, too.
Yeah,
what does
really,
that mean?
You know, the capacity level, when we're talking about whether the person has the capacity to sign the will, it's really a pretty low standard.
Mm-hmm.
Really, all the person has to know is at the time of signing the will, they have to know the natural objects of their bounty. That's the way it's stated in the law and in mm-hmm. the cases and in the jury instructions.
And that
so
means
and so
who's
forth.
Who would be the normal people.
Right.
In
it'd
their
be
family.
Your wife and kids in
right.
a typical, you know, marital unit type situation. You just have to know the natural objects of your bounty. You generally have to know what assets you have. You don't have to know that to the penny,
mm-hmm.
but generally know what you have and have the capacity to know that. You have to have enough capacity to understand that you're actually making a will and the effect of what you're doing.
Mm-hmm.
So, and it's not necessarily that, you know, if there's situations around the execution of the will before or after that maybe you know, the person does not have that capacity, but at the time of signing, they were maybe in a lucid interval, they were doing well, our cases deal with that. So, and what I'm talking about there is that is it at the time of signing the document is what we look at.
Mm-hmm.
So that becomes very important there. Well, the witnesses, you know, obviously how was the person presenting, what questions were asked of him. If there's an attorney involved, the attorney, you know, that, as it relates to how the person presented, so on and so forth. I make a point, as an attorney, when I'm sitting down with my clients and on will execution time, to ask questions that are very open-ended.
Mm-hmm.
I don't say, aren't your children Jack, Jim, and Joe? You know,
yeah, right.
I say, tell me the name of your kids.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And I say, well, tell me generally what your assets are. Tell me where your property is. Where do you live? Where do you bank?
Mm-hmm.
And I do that every single time. Not with the person who walks in who's like Sam. I mean, obviously,
right,
Sam,
right.
I have capacity, but
that's debatable.
If it's someone who's, you know, on up in age and maybe someone may raise a question about it, I'm going to do that every time. And the reason I do that, obviously, is because I don't want to feed the answer to the person.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to be able to say, if I'm a witness, you know, to indicate that I do this every time and this is the way I do it. Well,
now, this goes back to the procedure question, too, that came also mm-hmm. has come up before. Is that at the time of signing?
Yes.
You would be asking those questions.
Mm-hmm. Correct.
Correct.
Okay. Correct. I mean, you know, if we're in a situation where I'm asked to go to the nursing home to see the person in the hospital, and I arrive and I talk to the person about what his or her intent is, and I determine they don't have the capacity, well, the appointment ends right there.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if they don't have the capacity at that point in time, I don't even know how to prepare the document.
Right.
And I've done that on many occasions.
The document's already prepared and ready to go.
Well, no, it could be that the first appointment,
right.
I'm having to meet with the person at the hospital, for example,
mm-hmm.
and you know, maybe the kids called or the spouse called and said, you know, my dad doesn't have a will.
Doesn't have.
Will
one,
you go
right.
meet with him?
Right.
I go meet with him, and he doesn't have the capacity. Well, we're going to have to just circle the wagons again, and come back later or see if he gets better. Those kind of things. But if you're at a point where, let's say, he does have capacity when you meet with him the first time,
mm-hmm.
but then on signing day he doesn't have capacity, then we just can't proceed forward, you know, with the document. Obviously, in that type of situation, we monitor the health, and in the event that you know, maybe there's a time of day
mm-hmm.
that he's better. I mean, sometimes you have the sundowner
sure,
folks;
exactly.
they're good at 10 o'clock yeah. in the morning. But you get to 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock in the afternoon, they're not. Then maybe we need to, you know, meet with them, this person, at, you know, earlier in the day.
Okay. Now, let me ask you this before we get to the next break here, too. Okay. So you have these issues, and you believe these issues are at play. Do you go to the clerk? Where do you go to start with this?
Ben, I think the first thing is that you need to meet with an attorney first, mm-hmm. figure out how this process should go. One thing that Wes just mentioned was the fact of lucid intervals. These things can happen even when you have Alzheimer's patients, stuff
sure.
like that. There can be times where they have full capacity to execute a will. So you need to sit down with an attorney. You need to go over these types of issues, discuss mental health history, all these types of things. And then if there has not been, if there's a will on file that you believe is suspect, we would then need to file with the clerk's office a notice of caveat. That will then get transferred to the superior court, and then we're in the middle of a lawsuit for the
okay.
caveat.
All right. So
that's the will side of it. But when we're talking about undue influence as it relates to changing beneficiaries on accounts that pass outside the will,
mm-hmm.
in many cases after the death, the family may have been excluded. Mm-hmm. So they don't really know what's out there.
They don't know.
And there's no filtering process because those assets don't go through probate.
Mm-hmm.
They're not reported. Okay, so we don't have a public record to be able to go see what those assets are.
Right.
So a lot of times folks feel like that they're powerless. I think that mom had more, you know, but Uncle Joe moved in and just
right.
kind of took over. I think he may have done something. We asked him about it. He won't answer any questions. What do I do next, Mr. Collins?
Mm-hmm.
You know, we get those questions all the time. And, you know, where you start with that, where the attorney starts with that, is, you know, asking in a formal way very pointed questions about the things that we're looking for, all non-probate assets,
mm-hmm.
account designations, beneficiary designation documents, when those were signed, powers of attorney that were put in place,
mm-hmm.
those type things. And at least half the time when we're dealing with someone who has engaged in undue influence, the response to that is either not responsive
mm-hmm.
or it's like partially responsive. And you can just kind of read between the lines that something's going on. And then in those type cases, we in many situations have to file an action based on constructive fraud or based on, you know, undue influence
right.
or some of the claims so that we can then conduct discovery and get all of the information with regard to the non-probate assets and peel back those layers.
Would that go right to Superior Court then?
That is a plaintiff versus defendant lawsuit in Superior Court. Yes, where a caveat is what we call an in rem proceeding. It's a little different.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, I have more to come in a moment here. If you have questions, 247-7282.
Thank you.
Hey, welcome back. 247-7282 here if you'd like to ask those questions. Again, talking about challenges to will and also just in general and undue influence as well.
Right. So, you know, Sam and I have tried a fair number of these cases. I've been practicing a lot longer than Sam, so I've tried a lot more, but he's a great right-hand man on these cases. You know, when issues come up that I'm right in the middle of the case, he's normally Johnny on the spot at whatever
but
comes up.
As you brought up, though, and for Wes and Sam, again, Wes Collins and Sam Morris joined us from Harvell and Collins, you don't know what you don't know. That seems to be the rub there. That's tough. I mean, that's also in family law cases, too. Sometimes your assets are hidden.
That's one of the reasons why it is so important to get involved with an attorney early on in the file before you have to breathe, you know, do CPR on a lawsuit or something like that, because the discovery process is designed to get rid of all those unknowns, right? We're supposed to figure out what we're going to be doing at trial before we get to trial. We're not supposed to be any surprises at trial. And so discovery request for production of documents, identifying witnesses, all these things are things that the attorney working the file will or should know to do. Mm-hmm. And you should have a clear-cut picture of what at least the substance of what's coming out and the trial is going to be before the trial ever happens.
Yeah, knowing the answer to the questions before you ask the question.
And right? Depositions. Depositions are very, very important.
Yeah,
right. So I think we just have a minute or so left. You know, I would tell folks that, you know, if they have questions and they feel like something wasn't done right, or they feel like the information is not being provided to them, you know, after a loved one has passed away, and this is a loved one who you would expect to, you know, right, for part of their estate to have passed to you, mm-hmm, maybe a mother, father, someone you were close with, don't feel as though that you don't have any remedy. There are lots of remedies in the law. The biggest problem that you can create for yourself, most likely, is to wait and not do anything. I can guarantee you, if you don't do anything, in almost every case, you'll never know what happened.
Assets disappear.
And there won't be any resolution of it. It'll just pass by the wayside. So know that there are mechanisms in order to, you know, do the discovery, understand what we're dealing with here, and then make an informed decision, educated decision about how to deal with the potential undue influence or fraud or whatever took place. And, you know, you can kind of feel it. You can kind of smell it. You can kind of just get the feeling about it when there's something going on there.
Right.
And normally you start getting that feeling before the person passed away.
Yeah. All right, again, if you want to find out more, you want to call on the folks at Harvell & Collins Attorneys at Law, and you can get an appointment with them and also go online and find past shows as well at harvellandcollins.com. Call them at 726-9050.